This message comes from Capital One. Your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services backed by the strength of a top 10 commercial bank. Visit CapitalOne.com/commercial. Member FDIC.
The Oscars are approaching and the nominations have covered some very big hits, some very small gems, and everything in between. Fresh faces, familiar veterans, it's all here, and so are we.
If you're a movie lover, and if you're entering an Oscar pool, or if you're just looking to catch up on what's good, we're here to help. I'm Aisha Harris.
And I'm Linda Holmes. On this episode of NPR's Pop Culture Happy Hour, we're offering up a guide to this year's Oscar nominations. Joining us today are our fellow Pop Culture Happy Hour hosts, Stephen Thompson. Hey, Stephen.
Hello, Linda.
And Glenn Weldon. Hi, Glenn.
Hey, Linda.
So several of us have been covering the Oscars for a very long time together, since 2011.
God.
I counted 106 Best Picture nominees.
They're all winners.
All winners.
They're all winners in our book. Not a dud in the bunch.
Even the ones we've forgotten about. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, 2011, which was our first Oscar year, was the James Franco and Anne Hathaway year.
Oh, boy.
We have covered through 11 different hosts, The Slap, the incorrect Best Picture announcement, and I remembered Adele Dazeem, by John Travolta as the name of Idina Menzel.
Good times.
But, my dear, we're still here.
It's true. We are.
And look, this is, I mean, like, we all have to watch movies that may not be to our personal taste for this, but we're not mining coal here, people. This isn't Deadliest Catch.
Exactly.
But I'll be honest, you know, sometimes, and just between the four of us, I hope no one else is listening, when when I'm watching, like, Tom Hanks, whatever he's doing in Elvis, and we don't have time to go into it, but what he's doing, I swear to God, is Watto in Star Wars The Phantom Menace. I have proof. You know, some light and life can kind of leech from the world. Am I crazy? You feel that, right?
I do, but I also always feel like I get to watch some things that I wouldn't otherwise watch. And,
that's,
you know, because we have seen all of the movies that are nominated in these big categories we're going to talk about. And I'm always happy to catch up.
Yeah. And this is Hollywood's biggest night and we cover Hollywood. So we got to enjoy it a little bit, right?
It's true. It's true. Well, I am so glad to be here with all of you for our big Oscar show. We have all seen all of these nominees, so we have plenty of thoughts. First, we're obviously going to spend some time on a category you may have heard of called Best Picture. There are 10 nominees this year, and you can divide them, I feel like, into a few basic sort of families of movies. Uh-huh. First, we have big hits. These are the films that made bank at the box office. Glenn, why don't you walk us through these nominations?
Sure. Well, first up is Avatar, The Way of Water. That's James Cameron's science fiction epic about the planet Pandora and its blue-skinned, pointy-eared inhabitants called the Na'vi.
The Way of Water connects all things.
It is a sequel to 2009's Avatar.
We cannot let you bring your war here.
Next up is Top Gun Maverick, also a sequel, this time to the 1986 movie Top Gun. Tom Cruise is back as rogue fighter pilot Maverick, who trains a new generation that includes the son of his pal from the first movie.
Your kind is headed for extinction.
Maybe so, sir.
Joseph Kosinski directs this one.
But not today.
Another big hit was Elvis. That's Baz Luhrmann's flashy, splashy musical biopic, starring Austin Butler as the king of rock and roll.
I can't move, I can't sing.
And Tom Hanks as his sinister manager.
Tomorrow, all America will be talking about Elvis Presley.
And also a box office hit, particularly within its own kind of indie category, is Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is the most nominated movie this year overall, 11 nominations in total.
Mrs. Wang, are you with us?
I am paying attention.
It's directed by Daniels, that is Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert. It is a sprawling, silly, big-hearted science fiction action adventure starring Michelle Yeoh as a Chinese immigrant who enters an expansive multiverse while being audited by the IRS.
The universe.
As you do.
Is so much bigger than you realize.
All right, so those are the box office hits. Then you have a group of nominees that, while they might not be hits in the same way, they feel like very traditional Oscar contenders with kind of clear ties to past nominees that we may recall. Aisha, tell us about these.
Yeah, well, first up, we have All Quiet on the Western Front, which is Edward Berger's German film
about a young soldier fighting on the Western Front of World War I. War films obviously have had a very long and successful history at the Oscars, so it's not at all a surprise that this is in this category. Then we have The Banshees of Inisherin, which is Martin McDonagh's film set during the Irish Civil War about two lifelong friends at an impasse.
Just tell me what I've done to you.
When you didn't do anything to me.
When one of them abruptly decides to end their relationship.
I just don't like you no more.
You didn't like me yesterday.
McDonagh is an established playwright whose work has been nominated before in this category. A few years ago, he had the film Three Billboards Outside Ebbing, Missouri, if you all remember that very polarizing movie.
Mm-hmm. We had thoughts.
And then we also have The Fablemans, which is Steven Spielberg's deeply personal film about a Jewish American boy.
Movies are dreams.
Who dreams of making movies.
That you never forget.
Spielberg, of course, has a long-standing relationship with the Oscars, and this is his 12th Best Picture nomination.
All right, so we've got big hits, we've got kind of traditional Oscar picks. Steven, give us a rundown of the remaining ones, which are kind of the maybe a little offbeat, welcome surprise kind of Oscar nominees.
Well, first up, you've got Tar. That's Todd Field's character study about a fictional world-famous composer and conductor played by Cate Blanchett.
You want to dance the mask, you must service the composer.
Then you've got Triangle of Sadness. That's Ruben Östlund's broad and vomit-filled satire.
The success of a luxury cruise mainly depends on you.
Set, at least in part, on a luxury yacht.
Yes!
And finally, we've got Women Talking. That's writer-director Sarah Polley's film about a group of Mennonite women who gather to discuss the abuse they've suffered at the hands of the men in their community.
We've liberated ourselves.
And they decide what to do next.
We will have to ask ourselves who we are.
Well, so Glenn, you read off the box office hits. There are a lot of kind of big money makers on this list, which has not always been the case. What do you sort of make of that?
Well, a couple things leap out. This was another weird year for seeing movies in theaters. You know, the movie houses were back open, yes, but the pandemic has gotten us all out of the habit of going out to see the movies. And those four films I mentioned, Avatar, Way of Water, Top Gun, Maverick, Elvis, and Everything Everywhere All at Once, what they offered was the kind of spectacle that you go out to see movies for, that got a lot of butts back in seats. If this had been a normal year, would a movie like Top Gun, Maverick have gotten a nomination? I don't know, but what I think we're seeing here is the Academy thanking filmmakers like Cameron and Cruise and Lerman for basically jumpstarting an industry that's deeply worried about its future because of streaming. And the fact that people actually saw these movies likely means that more people are going to be interested in the Oscars race, and that means that the ratings for the broadcast might be up, because the ratings for the Oscars broadcast have been down. And we know that is something the Academy worries about. We don't know exactly why the Academy worries about that, but we know they do. That's why they expanded the potential list of Best Picture nominees to 10 back in 2009. That was deliberately to include more popular movies into the Best Picture mix. And if there was ever any doubt, we saw just how thirsty they were last year when they introduced those weird online polls about the most cheerable moments in cinema, which is how we all came to realize that the moment in Justice League when the Flash entered the Speed Force was the most important moment in cinema. Rosebud Schmozebud. That's what matters.
We all remember where we were.
Yeah. Well, there is a clip going around of Steven Spielberg thanking Tom Cruise for, like, getting people back to the theaters for Top Gun. So clearly it's coming from within the Academy, as Glenn said, where there's just, like, there's this hope that people will continue to go see movies on the big screen, in the theater, live, and in around other people. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the industry is saying that even with all of these hits, we're still trending in the other direction.
Yeah,
I like the idea of Steven Spielberg thanking Tom Cruise for getting people back to the movies, only to release The Fablemans, a movie very, very few people have seen. But I do want to sound an optimistic note for a second and just say that I do appreciate how much thematic breadth there is in this 10-picture field for Best Picture. The fact that they find room, obviously one of the reasons they found room for Top Gun Maverick is that it made a boatload of money, but I appreciate the fact that somebody made a very good sequel to Top Gun, and that is considered in the same breath as kind of a more typical arty kind of Oscar movie, I appreciate the fact that the field doesn't just consist of nothing but kind of stultifyingly serious historical dramas, because we've had fields like that in past years where you're just kind of dredging through The Imitation Game and Darkest Hour and these kind of grim, portentous historical dramas. The fact that you have a field that includes a very ambitious science fiction epic and Everything Everywhere All at Once, a traditional war movie like All Quiet on the Western Front, a Top Gun sequel, an Avatar sequel, an Elvis biopic. I do appreciate that there's room for a bunch of different kinds of movies, even if these aren't necessarily the 10 movies I would have picked as the 10 best movies of 2022. I like the idea of expanding the definition of what constitutes a great movie. I'd love to see more comedies get Oscar nominations as a pulpit I pound on every single year. But I do appreciate that there are a bunch of different kinds of movies here.
Yeah, I appreciate that too. I did find this year to be a year where, as I went through these films, I had several where I very much admired kind of the contributions that the filmmakers were making to kind of the craft of filmmaking, the visual effects in Avatar, the flying scenes in Top Gun. You know, even the kind of Baz Luhrmann split screen stuff that there's a lot of in Elvis. And yet there was some part of me that found it hard to connect with the hearts of a lot of these films. And what I don't want to see is a world where, yes, we can nominate lots of different kinds of films, but we sort of don't expect everything to have a heart, because you can make any kind of movie, including a visual effects heavy epic or a stunt heavy action movie, and still have a little more heart than I found in some of these films. And so I do hope that they continue to prioritize, like, still please write a script, you know, still please write a script that is compelling. Because one of the things that's missing from this list is what I found to be one of the most emotionally moving films of the year, which is After Sun, which was directed by Charlotte Wells and is about father and daughter on a vacation together. And it's not flashy. It's very visually inventive, but it's not as technically flashy. And I wanted more films like that that really, really moved me, because I don't want to see a division between these are the emotional movies and these are the technical achievements, because those things can exist in the same films.
And I think those things did exist in some movies that had come out but weren't nominated, like The Woman King, yes, which I think right. could have easily had the slot that something like Top Gun or Avatar had. And look, I enjoyed Top Gun for what it was, but The Woman King was operating on a slightly different level in terms of both emotional tug at the heartstrings, as well as the technicality and sort of the fight scenes, the way those were choreographed were so well done and visceral in the best ways possible.
And another movie that has a lot of heart and is also a spectacle is Everything Everywhere All at Once. Can we take a moment, please, to appreciate what a deeply, deeply bizarre movie Everything Everywhere All at Once is? And it's up for maybe the most punishingly basic mainstream prize in all of popular culture. I mean, if it wins, it's going to make history as the weirdest movie ever to win Best Picture. And to be clear, that's a good thing.
Yes.
I'm still surprised. I still don't quite believe it. But I grew up ignoring all the major categories in the Oscars because, as Stephen mentioned, they were all historical epics and bloated biopics and actors slapping on prosthetics to feign a disability or being so very, very brave as to play a queer person. And so I got used to the Academy tossing the films that I liked the same bone every year, which was the screenplay category, right? Do the Right Thing, Being John Malkovich, Ghost World, Adaptation, Heavenly Creatures, In the Loop, Sex, Lies, and Videotape, The Usual Suspect, The Grifters, In Bruges. Those are the movies that I was home waving my little rah-rah pennant for every time, right? And to be clear, the Academy is still shutting out some great movies for Best Picture, but still trying to have their cake and eat it too by doling out screenplay nominations for films like Can You Ever Forgive Me and The Lobster and Knives Out and Ex Machina. But if they give the Academy Award on Oscar night for Best Picture to a film that is all bagels and butt plugs, I won't know what to do with my damn self.
Well, I don't think we should overstate how much Everything Everywhere All at Once does check an enormous number of boxes for a Best Picture winner. You know, one of the things that we debate when we're talking about what is likeliest to win, box office comes into play, right? One of the reasons several people have predicted Top Gun Maverick might win Best Picture is that it made more than $1 billion worldwide and that got butts back into seats. I think the same not only is true of Avatar: The Way of Water, but is really also true of Everything Everywhere All at Once. It checks the box office box. It checks the inventiveness box. But I think of all of this field, it probably has the most of what Linda was talking about, hard as it is to quantify, as heart. This is a very sentimental film in a lot of ways. It triggers a lot of sentimental appreciation, not only for its themes and its execution, but for its actors. And I think in that way, it's a little bit more of a traditional Oscar box checker than it might seem in its weirdest moments.
Nevertheless, I do think it is worth recognizing that one of the previous films by these filmmakers is Swiss Army Man, which is about a man kept company by a corpse.
Uh-huh. A farting corpse.
Yes.
A farting corpse, to be fair.
And I think that trajectory is one that I like a lot, that you can make a movie that is really widely talked about for how weird it is, like Swiss Army Man, and then you can, you know, still keep your sort of odd vision and your very particular idiosyncratic approach and maybe one day be nominated for Best Picture. So I dig that. Before we share some of our own predictions, I want to mention that the Oscar voting for Best Picture is done by preferential ballots. And if you need a refresher on what that means, it means that voters rank the movies rather than picking just one. In practice, what's the effect of that? It means that a movie can do really well if it's not everybody's first choice, but it's a very popular second or third choice. It's basically a system that rewards being near the top of a lot of ballots, and it can make it harder to win if you're a love-hate kind of movie where people who didn't rank you first maybe ranked you last. So as we make our predictions, just bear that in mind. Also bear in mind as we record this, not all of the precursor awards, the kind of lead-up awards, have been given out. So we don't have all the data that we will have on Oscar night when they're about to open the envelopes. But knowing what we do, we're going to talk about what we think should win and will win Best Picture. Aisha, I'm going to start with you. What do you think should win and will win?
Okay, so I think what should win Best Picture is Everything Everywhere All at Once, for all the many reasons we kind of already touched on. But will win, I think, is The Fabelmans, because of the fact that Steven Spielberg at this point is such a institution within the Academy, and this is a very personal film. And I also don't want to discount the fact that this movie does deal with anti-Semitism in a moment when we are really kind of, that's at the forefront of our mind outside of Hollywood. So I can see that story, the connection to Spielberg, and also its very timeliness, really resonating with voters this year.
All right. Stephen Thompson, what do you think should win, will win?
Well, I do love The Fabelmans, and I think Aisha raises some compelling arguments for it. I worry about its box office, but my pick for should win and will win is Everything Everywhere All at Once. I have talked in great detail about how much I love this film. I will spare you a regurgitation of that. But I do want to talk a little bit about the prevailing mood of the movie industry, which is one of the kind of the big themes that you take into the Oscars this year. And there's a lot of feeling that the industry is at a crossroads where there are movies that make a ton of money at the box office, but they tend to be these large-scale, tentpole, hundreds of millions of dollars, intellectual property-driven, your Top Gun Maverick, your Avatar The Way of Water. Those movies cost a fortune, and they are kind of pre-existing franchises. And I think Everything Everywhere All at Once, the fact that it made a bunch of money at the box office really works in its favor. This is a movie that is really helping to brighten the future of the movie industry, right? These are like young upstart directors who made a movie that had really a much wider appeal than you would ever imagine, given some of the components contained within it. To me, this movie makes the future look bright for the movie industry, and that is really, really important right now.
All right. So Stephen is a should win and will win for Everything Everywhere All at Once. Glenn, how about you?
Should win Everything Everywhere All at Once for all the reasons we've talked about. Will win? Well, here's my theory of the case. I've got a bulletin board with red yarn and a lot of thumbtacks. I think younger Oscar voters are going to go for Everything Everywhere All at Once, which is only meat and fitting. I think older Oscar voters are going to go for The Fabelmans. It's Spielberg. It is magic of the movies. It's more than that. And in the sense that it is any more than that, that's all to do with the Michelle Williams performance that we'll talk about soon. So if, follow me now, if Everything Everywhere All at Once is the younger folks' choice and Fablemans is the older folks' choice, everybody's second or third choice is going to be, I think, Banshees of Inisherin, which I'd be fine with because it looks like it's this sweet, charming, bucolic fable of life in an Irish village, but it's really pretty dark. And if you're me, it's pretty funny and it's got a real edge and I could live with that. So should win Everything Everywhere All at Once and will win Banshees of Inisherin.
All right, Glenn Weldon, I am going to say should win. Yes, also Everything Everywhere All at Once. I think you all make compelling cases. I worry a little bit that Everything Everywhere may have peaked a little too early, as I think did Tar. There was a time when it seemed to me like it might be Tar. I think that's past that moment. So I'm going to say we'll win Everything Everywhere All at Once because I'm thinking with my heart. That's what I'm doing. That's what I'm choosing to do.
There you go.
All right. Now we're going to turn to this year's performances, the glamorous stars, and the up-and-coming faces who are vying for the acting Oscars, and of course, the melodramatic speeches. One fun fact is that there were 16 first-time acting nominees between the lead and supporting categories. We'll talk about some of them as we go. We're going to start with Best Actress. Stephen, why don't you kick us off?
So I would say we can pretty much all agree there are two assumed frontrunners in this category. The first is Cate Blanchett for Tar. She plays Lydia Tar, a fictional and very egotistical composer and conductor who starts to face the consequences of her own behavior. Blanchett has won two Oscars in the past. The second frontrunner would be Michelle Yeoh in Everything Everywhere All at Once. She plays Evelyn Wong, the co-owner of a laundromat. She goes off to an IRS audit and gets sucked into an adventure that also involves her husband and her daughter. Yeoh is a veteran actor who has somehow, I can still be surprised, somehow never been nominated before, and she is the first actress nominated in this category who identifies as Asian. Then you've got Michelle Williams, who's nominated for The Fablemans. She plays Mitzi, the loving but troubled mother of the film's young protagonist. Ana de Armas is nominated for playing Marilyn Monroe in Blonde, a movie I hated. It's probably worth noting that this is a film that is loosely based on a novel that is loosely based on Marilyn Monroe's actual life. So you are getting into a pretty rough approximation of Marilyn Monroe. I will have more to say about that in a moment. And maybe the biggest surprise when the nominations came out has to do with the last nominee, Andrea Riseborough. Glenn, tell us more about this particular nomination.
Well, Riseborough has been around a long time. You might have seen her in the film Birdman or The Death of Stalin and on TV in Black Mirror. In the drama To Leslie, she plays a woman trying to get out from under an addiction to drugs and alcohol.
I want to be a good mama again. Baby, I want to be a good mama. I do. I love you so much, baby. Who are you calling? Are you calling Grandma? You do not call my mother! She is my mother! You do not call my mother!
Well, this was a very, very small movie that not a lot of people saw when it came out last year, although critics really loved that performance. The campaign to get Riseborough nominated was different from the typical big, expensive campaigns that studios run that involve all those for-your-consideration billboards and magazine ads. This was a socially driven campaign, and it involved people with big social followings. A lot of famous actors, Gwyneth Paltrow, Edward Norton, Charlize Theron, they talked up the performance and tried to get other folks to watch it and sometimes even hosted screenings to support it. One of the reasons people are talking about this nomination by these kind of unconventional means was that the Academy for years has been making noises about diversifying its membership and then hopefully, by extension, its nominees and its winners. And two of the women who weren't nominated this year were very highly regarded Black actresses who were considered to have solid chances. Not a lock, of course, there's no such thing as a lock, but they were really thought that Viola Davis in The Woman King and Daniel Deadwyler in Till would get nominations. So while there may be a variety of kinds of campaigning that can work, the field we ended up with is a distinction without a difference. We ended up ultimately leaving out Black women just as we often have in the past. So you got different methods, but at least in this sense, you get the same result. So what do you guys think of the Andrea Riseborough nomination? We'll double back to the other ones. But Aisha, how do you unpack all of this?
Yeah, I mean, this is really interesting to watch unfold because on the one hand, I totally get the sort of frustrations with the idea that when we have people like Viola Davis or Daniel Deadwyler, and we don't hear that same amount of fervor from their peers, sort of like counting them up and trying, hoping that they will get the nomination, it does feel as though like solidarity is only for white women to some extent, as the phrasing goes. But then I look at one sort of notable deviation from this is the fact that several years ago, Monique, who was nominated for her role in Precious, the Best Supporting Actress role, she famously refused to campaign for the Best Supporting Actress nomination after she got it. And she still wound up winning, which I think is really fascinating to see because A, she's a Black woman. She's a Black woman who had never before that been in those spaces or been talked about it in those conversations. So the fact that she completely did not play the game and still wound up winning and stood by her principal and was like, look, the work is up on screen. This is what I'm going to do. It kind of laid bare the fact that it's not always going to play out the way we expect it to. Of course, the difference here is that with Andrea Riseborough, we saw how the sausage was being made, but there's always campaigning of some sort, even when you're not campaigning. The fact that Monique didn't campaign was in itself a campaign.
Yeah. What I think I missed when I first was hearing the kind of concern about this nomination was the kind of corrosive impact of having this social campaign referred to as organic or grassroots, as if somehow this was a campaign that took place outside the system, right? This is not a campaign that took place outside the system by any means. Yep. This is simply a campaign that substituted access to social resources, which are basically connections. She's heavily connected to a bunch of different people in a bunch of different ways. It substituted that kind of social capital for the funding that you get in a campaign that's run by somebody like Netflix. So it is system all the way down. That's the problem. So although I definitely think this is a very, very good performance and a nomination that substantively I have no problem with, I think the way it is talked about has to be done very carefully so that you don't suggest that this is somehow just like an organic, it emerged out of the fog based on nothing but fairness, you know?
Yeah, I think that's really, really well put. I agree with everything you said, including the points you made about this being an extremely credible performance. Had this had a traditional Oscar campaign behind it, it would have been nominated. Maybe that film might have even gotten other nominations along the way. What I find objectionable in this field of nominees is the nomination for Ana de Armas in Blonde. What this film has in common with The Whale, which we'll talk about in a moment when we talk about Brendan Fraser, is that both of these films confuse pity with empathy. And basically, you could boil down both films' attitude toward their main characters as, oh, that poor creature. And it is a very dehumanizing look at Marilyn Monroe. And that's a performance that got a big push from Netflix. So, you know, looking at this field and looking at the levels of fairness that went into crafting this field, this is the performance that I really fixated on while I was alternately and sometimes simultaneously bored and mad watching this movie.
Yeah, I agree. I just don't think it has anything to say about Marilyn Monroe. I think it's a 3-hour adaptation of the Elton John song Candle in the Wind. And that is, to me, where the movie begins and ends. All right, so I want to talk about who we think should and will win. Steven obviously thinks that Ana de Armas should win. No, I'm just kidding. Steven, who do you think should and will win in the category of Best Actress?
Well, like a lot of people, I'm torn between Cate Blanchett and Michelle Yeoh. I think this Blanchett performance is a really tremendous, dynamic, kind of powerhouse performance. I think it will win. For should, I am rooting for Michelle Yeoh, who just gets to do so much in Everything Everywhere at Once, gets to use her entire toolkit, gets to be an action star and a serious actor and so many other things. So for me, in the should, I'm rooting for Michelle Yeoh, but I'll be delighted with Cate Blanchett.
All right, Aisha, who do you think should and will win in Best Actress?
I'm being very optimistic, and I'm going with will and should win is Michelle Yeoh. I just feel like the moment is happening. I feel like this is her time. Her fame has grown over the years, and I think there's just so much goodwill toward her. So I will be so happy when she does win, because that's what's going to happen. I'm putting it out there.
I love it. How about you, Glenn Weldon? Should and will win in the category of Best Actress?
Should and will, Michelle Yeoh. But I think the Michelle Williams nomination is really interesting, because I think a lot of her people were suggesting that she submit for Supporting Actress, and I'm glad she didn't. That is, in The Fablemans, a lead performance. votes and it's where it belongs. But before the nominations came out, a lot of people were thinking that this was going to be yet another year of Hollywood celebrating itself and the magic of the movies, because we had Fablemans, we had Babylon, we had Empire of Light. That didn't materialize. And although the Fablemans is certainly a testament to the magic of the movies, it's more than that. And the fact that it is because of the strength and the idiosyncratic nature of the Michelle Williams performance. But yeah, should and will, Michelle Yeoh, and I'll be happy.
All right. I agree, should and will, Michelle Yeoh, although I do think Cate Blanchett is always in the running in these situations. Mm-hmm. And Stephen, you mentioned her getting to be an action star. You mentioned her getting to be a serious actress. I want to play one quick clip that touches on something else that she is in this movie.
Rakakuni.
What?
Rakakuni. You know, the one with the chef. And he makes bad food. Pui. And then this raccoon sit on his head. Ooh, control him. And then he cooks good food.
Do you mean Ratatouille?
Ratatouille? Like that movie.
No. Rakakuni. With the raccoon.
I absolutely love this scene because it is so funny and she is so funny in it. In the middle of this kind of multiverse epic, you get this moment where she is referring to Ratatouille as Rakakuni. And I love it. It is a great moment. And I love the fact that in addition to being an action star and in addition to being a beautiful dramatic actress, she gets to be so funny in this. So I agree, should and will, Michelle Yeoh. Gotta love it. Let's move on to lead actors. Aisha, who is nominated in this category?
Well, we all know that the Academy loves a big, splashy biopic, so I guess we'll have to start with Austin Butler for Elvis. He plays, of course, Elvis Presley, complete with the hips, the snarl, and the southern drawl. Then we have Colin Farrell for The Banshees of Inisherin. He plays Park, an Irish farmer who's heartbroken and confused when his friend, who's played by Brendan Gleeson, decides he no longer wants to be friends with him. I imagine a lot of us have had similar dynamics throughout our lives. It's very relatable. There's also beloved actor and one-time mummy fighter Brendan Fraser, who is nominated for The Whale. He plays a gay 600-pound writing teacher who's housebound and in failing health. That movie was directed by Darren Aronofsky. Paul Mescal is maybe one of the surprises in this category, if there are any. I was actually kind of surprised, pleasantly surprised to see he's here. He's nominated for a quiet drama called After Sun. He plays a troubled father on vacation in Turkey with his 11-year-old daughter. And it's this really moving film from the writer and director Charlotte Wells that I hope lots of people are checking out after its nomination. It's, by the end of it, I was sobbing. It was so good. And finally, there's Bill Nye, who's nominated for the drama Living. He plays a man who learns he only has a few months to live and decides to shake up his routine. It's probably also worth noting that all of the men in this category are first-time nominees, which rarely happens. So that's going to be exciting. Whoever wins, it's going to be their first time.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and it's true because it's a combination of people who have been around forever, where it's kind of surprising that they're first-time nominees, mm-hmm. and then people who are newer to the scene, and maybe it's not so surprising. Glenn, tell me how this race shapes up for you.
Well, that Nye performance in Living is so interior, its surface is so still and very, very British, that I think some voters might not look underwater and see just how fast he's paddling there. Mm-hmm. The Fraser performance in The Whale, you know, it's very sincere, it's very deeply felt, but the movie around it is really insincere and really disingenuous and fake. He could still win. I'd be happy for him. But it would mean that more people would probably subject themselves to that movie. And I can in good conscience root for that. Austin Butler. The Oscars love themselves a biopic. As Aisha mentioned, they love a transformation. I didn't register that performance because I spent my whole time in that movie just puzzled by Tom Hanks. Paul Mescal. Love to see him included here. Loved After Sun. Really liked what he does. Deeply interior performance, but he's driven by something dark that lets you sort of see something splashing out around the edges. But could and should is Colin Farrell. That performance is so wounded and human and funny. And if he does win, as I hope he should get two little tiny Oscar statuettes alongside, for one for each of his eyebrows.
All right. Very nice. Stephen Thompson should and will win Best Actor.
I think Austin Butler has been playing the game that to me says he will win. I think he's been working the circuit really, really, really hard. I loved this Paul Mescal performance in After Sun. I did love Colin Farrell, but I'm going with will win, Austin Butler. Am I going to say should win? I think he's great. I think he's great in the film. I think he is as good as Tom Hanks is doing whatever he's doing.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. Aisha Harris should and will win Best Actor.
Well, keeping it with Austin Butler, I think he will win. This feels like the Bohemian Rhapsody, Rami Malek, that performance, although this is far better than that performance. Butler does a fine job with the musical numbers, and it's really cool that he's still doing the Elvis accent in real life, like months after playing this role. So he's clearly
Is it cool?
I was being facetious. Yes, he's very committed to that role. But I think the role as it was written is just kind of an infantilization of the Elvis Presley character. And Butler doesn't rise above that outside of the musical numbers. So I think he's going to win, despite all of that. Should win. For me, it's Colin Farrell. He takes a meaty role that's steeped in despair, discomfort, and he brings so much humanity and pathos to it. And I would just love to see him win because he's been doing such good work for a very long time now. And I'm so glad to see us in this era of like Colin Farrell being respected as an actor and not just as a really, really hot man.
How has he never been nominated before?
Dude, I don't know. It's his time.
All right. I think that Austin Butler will win. It is a biopic. It is very flashy and fancy. And I think it's going to be the Academy's Let's Reward a Newcomer. There are two performances in this category that I really, really love. Colin Farrell and Paul Mescal. Would not be sad at all if Colin Farrell won. But I am pulling hard, hard, hard for Paul Mescal, who is the one kind of big category nominee for my favorite movie of the year, After Sun. So I am pulling for Paul Mescal, and I think he should win. Up next, we'll talk about more of the Oscar nominees, the supporting actor and actress nominations, and director. Grab those cheat sheets and come right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel. On The Sympathizer podcast, host Philip Nguyen joins the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen to discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer Sundays exclusively on Max and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Teladoc Health. There are lots of reasons for wanting to be healthy. Family, work, living a fuller life. Teladoc Health understands. Whether you have diabetes, high blood pressure, or just need to manage your weight, Teladoc Health can help. Visit teladochealth.com/whatsyourwhy for more information. That's TELADOC health/whatsyourwhy.
Let's dive right back in and talk about the nominations for acting in a supporting role. It seems only right to start our supporting actress conversation with Angela Bassett. She's nominated for Black Panther, Wakanda Forever. She plays Wakanda's Queen Ramonda, the grieving mother of Shuri, played by Letitia Wright, and T'Challa, played by the late Chadwick Boseman. The film is a sequel to 2018's Black Panther. It's directed by Ryan Coogler. This nomination is the first one ever for a performance in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. It's the second of Bassett's career. Carrie Condon is nominated for playing Parik's sister, Siobhan, in The Banshees of Inisherin. She winds up being a kind of frustrated mediator between her brother and his estranged friend. Hong Chau plays Liz, who's the caretaker to Brendan Fraser's character in The Whale. And then there are two nominated performances from Everything Everywhere All at Once. Jamie Lee Curtis plays Deirdre, a dour IRS auditor who finds her own kind of grace eventually. Curtis is another industry veteran who's a first-time nominee. And finally, Stephanie Hsu plays Joy, Evelyn's daughter, who also takes the form of a fascinating and nihilistic villain in the multiverse. So, Stephen, who do you think should and will win?
Well, it seems like a lot of the momentum is on Angela Bassett. That certainly seems like a strong possibility. I still feel like Carrie Condon is the likeliest to win. That performance was enormously beloved, and she grounds that film in a really interesting way. My sentimental should-win pick, I'm looking at Stephanie Hsu. She is playing kind of a lot of parts in that film, and she is very crucial to that. I really, really dug that performance. But I'm ultimately going to say Carrie Condon will win, and Stephanie Hsu should.
All right. Thank you very much. Aisha Harris will and should win supporting actress.
I am being very optimistic here, which is not common, I know. But will win and should win. I'm going with Angela Bassett. I can't believe she's only been nominated one other time before this for What's Love Got to Do with It nearly 30 years ago. But Black women have historically had more luck in this category than in the Best Actress category. So it doesn't seem to me out of the realm of the possibility that this could be her win. And if she does, she would be the first performer for a Marvel movie to win an Oscar. So that's cool for all you Marvel people.
Yep, absolutely. All right, Glenn Weldon should and will win supporting actress.
I hate to see Curtis and Chu splitting the Everywhere Everything vote. I'd be happy for both of them for very different reasons. Condon takes a pretty underwritten character, really gives her an interior life. Hong Chao will be fine. She will have another shot in a much better movie, guaranteed. If Angela takes it, and I think she will, that'll be great. If they do, I hope they do a bit. I hope they cut to shots of all the other big-name actors who appeared in MCU films at home watching the ceremony, Robert Redford smashing a glass and Glenn Close smearing her face with lipstick and Larry Fishburne in the shower with his clothes on, you know, crying and hugging himself. That's what I want.
All right. That sounds very reasonable. Okay, so in this category, I think Angela Bassett will win. Just out of well-deserved regard for Angela Bassett and well-deserved regard for this franchise and this role and this film, I would be happy with a bunch of these nominees. I would be delighted to see Stephanie Hsu, but I'm going to say will win Angela Bassett and honestly should win Angela Bassett just because she's Angela Bassett.
Hear, hear.
Let's talk supporting actors. Glenn, who is nominated in this category?
Okay, in The Banshees of Inisherin, Brendan Gleeson plays Colm. He's a fiddler who suddenly dumps his friend Parik, that's the Colin Farrell character, with no explanation and then goes to increasingly extreme, increasingly dark, and if you're me, increasingly funny, measures to be left alone. In the same film, Barry Keoghan plays Dominic, a young, vulnerable, not particularly smart, but kind of sweet guy who just wants to live a very simple and happy life. There wasn't a lot of buzz about the film Causeway, which is on Apple TV, but it got a nomination for the great and good Brian Tyree Henry, who people might know from Atlanta, where he plays the rapper Paperboy. He's nominated for his work here as James, a mechanic who befriends a soldier played by Jennifer Lawrence. She's working to rehabilitate herself after a brain injury. It's a very quiet performance, but he's Brian Tyree Henry, and he is officially great in everything. Judd Hirsch isn't in The Fablemans for very long, about 10 minutes. He plays Uncle Boris, who kind of sweeps into the movie, has one very important monologue to young Sammy, that's the Spielberg stand-in, and then disappears. But it was a very chewy monologue, and it earned him a nomination. I think we'd say he denched it. Judi Dench was in Shakespeare in Love playing Queen Elizabeth for like 8 minutes, and she won, so it could happen. And finally, a very sentimental favorite around here, Ki Hui Kwan, who plays Evelyn's husband, Wayman, in Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Kwan, of course, was a child actor. He played Short Round in Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, and then Hollywood largely refused to cast the guy in anything as a teenager or as an adult, and now he's roaring back with this performance that's already won him an armful of awards and has made him, to I think a lot of people's belief, the favorite to win the Oscar. It's tough to call his character the heart of that film because that film has all kinds of hearts beating all over the place. But Stephen, what do you think? You think Kwan is the favorite here?
I think Ki Hui Kwan is absolutely the front runner to win here. I think he absolutely should win here. Kind of as we were talking about with Michelle Yeoh, this performance is a bunch of performances where he gets to bring action star, he gets to bring real vulnerability, he gets to bring great humor. He is a lovely story. He is a Hollywood comeback story, and people love those. But it is also just a magnificent performance that stuck with me all year. And both those performances in Banshees of Inisherin are great, but I do think they'll split votes.
All right. Thank you very much. Aisha Harris, what do you think? Should and will win?
Yeah, I think it's Ki Hui Kwan's year. The goodwill toward this performance is massive, especially among his peers. And if there is one comeback story that happens on Oscar tonight, I don't think it's necessarily going to be Brendan Fraser. I think it's going to be this. And I will be very happy because that performance is so just lovely. And like all the performances in that movie, Everything Everywhere All at Once, it is everything and it is everywhere and it is all at once. There's so many layers. So I really hope it happens. And I think it should happen. Ki Hui Kwan.
All right. How about you, Glenn Weldon?
Yeah, should and will. It's Kwan. It's a great story. It's a great performance. Brian Tyree Henry will be back another day. I'm yes. convinced of that.
Absolutely.
I agree. And this is the category where I think it's Ke-Huy Quan should and will, but I really like all of these performances. I particularly think this Barry Keoghan performance is mm-hmm. something where I just immediately thought, I cannot wait to see more and more and more from this kid who I think has been kind of gradually expanding what he gets to do. Brian Tyree Henry is great. Judd Hirsch is Judd Hirsch. And, you know, Brendan Gleeson is brilliant in this part that is so complicated. I love this category. This is probably my favorite yeah. category. Mm-hmm. I root for everybody. I could not be more delighted. So the last category we are covering today is directors. Of note, no women, despite really strong films from Sarah Polley with Women Talking, Gina Prince-Bythewood with The Woman King, seek out her recent essay about inclusion in the Oscars, and Charlotte Wells with After Sun, to name just three. No Black directors, neither Gina Prince-Bythewood nor Jordan Peele, whose very interesting film Nope was, like The Woman King, totally shut out. So again, not a year where the Academy can point to diversifying the nominees in the way that it has said it wanted to. These are really no surprise, though, if you have followed the rest of the nominations. Martin McDonagh is nominated for The Banshees of Inisherin. Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert, collectively known as Daniels, are nominated for Everything Everywhere All at Once. Steven Spielberg, who you may have heard of, is nominated for The Fabelmans. Todd Field is nominated for Tar. And Ruben Östlund is nominated for Triangle of Sadness. Aisha, what do you think of this field of directors? What do you think should and will win?
Well, I feel like this is such a toss-up between Daniels and Spielberg. Mm-hmm. On the one hand, because this is such a personal film, like for all of them, but especially for Steven Spielberg, and that it's really tied up into his persona, and he is one of our most celebrated and popular directors, I can see the voters leaning toward him. But at the end of the day, I think will win and should win is Daniels, mostly because I think they go really, really big, and voters can often gravitate towards big and showy in terms of technical achievement in the directing category. Look at something like Shape of Water, La La Land, The Revenant, Gravity, like just in the last few years. And this is not, sometimes we can mean this as a put down, but like, I feel like in many ways it is a kind of most directing of these films. And I mean that in the best way possible. So I think will and should win Daniels.
All right. How about you, Stephen Thompson? Should and will?
Well, I would definitely say for should, I would say Daniels. I'm not to sound like a broken record, favorite movie of the year. I do think this is kind of a two-horse race between them and Steven Spielberg. So I think it's ultimately down to those two. I predict Spielberg will win, but I would prefer the Daniels.
All right. How about you, Glenn Weldon? What do you think? Should and will?
Oh, I want them to give it to Daniels. They won't. They're going to give it to Spielberg. A, because Spielberg is Spielberg. B, because think about it. The Fabelmans constantly reminds you what exactly it is that a director does. We see this young kid organizing the extras. We see him talking his stars off a ledge. We see him finding the best shot. It is the Oscar voter equivalent of leading the witness, and I think Spielberg takes it.
I am going to say I think it should be Daniels, and I think it will be Daniels. I think secretly fewer people like The Fabelmans. Not sure people who aren't directors love that movie as much as people who are directors and revere Spielberg in the way that they do. I could be completely and totally wrong, but I think that it's going to be Daniels, and I will be absolutely delighted for all the reasons that you guys have already talked about. Phew. That has been a lot of nominations. You guys, do you feel like we covered enough?
I think we hit some major points. And Stephen, man, I want to believe you. I just think Everything Everywhere All at Once is too weird. I love to believe you're all right and it's going to win. I just can't see it. And if it wins, I have to question some pretty basic assumptions about myself. So,
I mean, I will say the Academy has surprised us in recent years between Nomadland, Parasite, Moonlight, mm-hmm. movies that I was not expecting to win, but they wound up somehow eking out a win. But yes, yeah.
Two words, Aisha. Green Book. Three words, The King's Speech.
Look, like MC Scat Cat said, like, two steps forward, one step back. That's what happens.
The immortal words.
That's how progress happens.
I think it's two steps forward and two steps. I can't.
Whatever he says.
You might be misquoting MC Scat Cat.
This is definitely exactly where I thought this conversation was going to go. It has been so much fun to talk to you guys about movies and Oscars and movies we liked and didn't like and MC Scat Cat. I cannot wait to sit down and watch the ceremony while furiously typing back and forth with all of you.
Same.
Same.
Happy Oscars, y'all.
Happy Oscars.
We will be staying up on Oscar night. We will be ready to run it all down, to talk about the surprises. And listen, you just never know what's going to happen. We were all together the night that the La La Land and Moonlight thing happened. We were shocked. Anyway, well, we obviously cannot get to every Oscars category today. Check out our feed for episodes where we have guides for other entire categories: original song, documentary feature, animated feature, and international feature. We want to know what you think about this year's Oscar nominees. Find us on Facebook at facebook.com/PCHH. Up next, what's making us happy this week?
This message comes from NPR sponsor BetterHelp. What's the right amount of socializing for you? Maybe you thrive around people, or maybe you need more alone time. Therapy can help you figure out your boundaries, how to recharge, and your social sweet spot, so you can build a social life that doesn't drain your battery. Try therapy with BetterHelp. It's entirely online, designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Visit BetterHelp.com/NPR today to get 10% off your first month. This message comes from NPR sponsor Be My Guest with Ina Garten, a podcast from Food Network. Intimate and captivating conversations with new and old friends. Jennifer Garner, Frank Bruni, Emily Mortimer, and more. Listen to Be My Guest wherever you get your podcasts. This message comes from NPR sponsor Mint Mobile. From the gas pump to the grocery store, inflation is everywhere. So Mint Mobile is offering premium wireless starting at just $15 a month. To get your new phone plan for just $15, go to mintmobile.com/switch.
Now it's time for our favorite segment of this week and every week, What's Making Us Happy This Week. Glenn Weldon, what is making you happy this week?
What's making me happy this week is Atsuko Okatsuka is a stand-up comic with a special that dropped on HBO and HBO Max last December. It's called The Intruder. She's been around for a while, and if you're extremely online, you might know her already because in 2019, she was performing on stage in Pasadena when an earthquake hit, and she helped keep the crowd calm. That became a moment. She also created a TikTok phenomenon called the Drop Challenge, in which people slowly squat while Beyoncé's partition kicks in. And any time a stand-up becomes known for something besides stand-up first, it can be worrisome. No need to worry here. She's got the goods. This special is very funny. Her presence on stage is so warm and open, and I've heard people call her childlike, and I don't quite buy that because I think it's more she's wise, she's strong, she's very self-determined, and the special revolves around an intruder in her backyard that keeps coming back. I've watched this thing twice because it is so well-structured, and it's got a very funny ending that it builds to kind of inevitably. And, of course, the whole reason we're talking about her is she's got a comic voice that is all her own. She sounds like nobody else. And she's on a lot of lists of comics to watch. And this special really bears that out. It's a great place to start with her. That's Atsuko Okatsuka, The Intruder, on HBO and HBO Max.
All right. Thank you very much, Glenn Weldon. Aisha Harris, what is making you happy this week, my friend?
Well, I think Glenn will appreciate this happy, personally. Mm-hmm. I am a board game fan, and one of the great things about board games is that they encourage you to do, and I put do in quotes, do things that you wouldn't actually do in real life. So something like Suburbia, I can build a government and an entire like town. Mm. Photosynthesis, I can plant trees, and that's a game. But now I'm obsessed thoroughly with Wingspan. Yes, Glenn, I finally started playing Wingspan.
Finally.
I know, Glenn and I have talked about this for months, but it's been sitting in our living room and my partner and I finally started playing it. It is so fun. I don't care about birds in real life, but the whole point of this game is to play birds and put them in different habitats, including the forest and the wetlands. And it's really pretty. It's beautifully designed by Elizabeth Hargrave. And it's just really fun. It's gotten to the point now where we have just left it on our table so we can just go and start playing a game randomly during the day. That's how obsessed I am with it. So if you're looking for a game, it's 1 to 5 players. I've never played it solo, but it's very fun with 2 players or more. And I think it's good for anyone who has kids, like younger, you know, 10, 12. I think they will really enjoy this. So that's Wingspan. It's fun. Go get it. Go play it.
All right. Thank you very much. I am really looking forward to the quote, "I don't care about birds," Aisha Harris, NPR.
Okay. I do. I just want to say that I do care about birds. I'm not a birder. That's what I mean.
There we go.
So don't come at me with a pitchfork.
All the birds are just going to troll you on Twitter.
We just lost our entire bird fan population. All right. Stephen Thompson, what is making you happy this week?
All right. So last night, in just a few hours, I blew through a really funny sad, thoughtful book called A Heart That Works by maybe my favorite person on the internet, the great Rob Delaney. We have talked about Rob Delaney on this show before. He's one of the stars and writers and creators of the TV show Catastrophe, which I also love. He is also maybe the funniest person on Twitter. As many people who follow him know, Rob Delaney's two-year-old son, Henry, died of brain cancer in 2018. And Delaney has written beautifully about grief and depression in the past. This book reaches beyond just grief and depression. It is extreme. It is vivid. It doesn't pull any punches, but it's also written by Rob Delaney, who cannot not be funny. This book is so humanistic. It is so disarming. It made me think more deeply about love and gratitude and parenthood and the ways that humans connect with each other and enrich each other's lives. He writes from a truly bottomless well of affection about his wife, about his kids, his family, caregivers, friends, art that helped him. There is so much gratitude in this book, and there's something so fearlessly, persistently loving in this piece of writing, which I just adored. My partner and I checked this book out from our local library. My next order of business is going to be to buy a copy to have on hand, because I'm going to want to loan this book to friends. I'm going to want to reread it, which I had never expected. When I cracked it open, I thought it was going to feel like homework, and it doesn't. That is A Heart That Works from the wonderful Rob Delaney.
All right. Thank you very much, Stephen Thompson. I feel like this is going to be a big switch in tone, so I apologize in advance. If you have been on Netflix anytime over the last few weeks as this episode is coming out, you may have been served up the show Physical 100. This is a Korean competition show that indeed starts with 100 people who compete in a series of physical, battles, challenges, various things. You know, you gotta pull a boat in a group. You got to wrestle people in water. You got to do various extremely physical things. In fact, eventually, I'm just going to spoil this much. You actually become Sisyphus pushing a rock up and over and over again. And I was not sure how I was going to feel about this when I watched the first episode. They do indeed try to introduce you to 100 people. And I felt like I'm never going to be able to keep track of all these different people. This is not 100 people from all walks of life. It's not like this is a school teacher. This is a stay-at-home parent.
Right. These are strong people.
It's all like CrossFitter, skeleton rider, like a lot of them are Olympic athletes. Some of them are already quite famous MMA fighters, people like that. I want you to ignore, if you decide to watch this, all the kind of portent at the beginning where they're talking about, we set out to find the perfect body. Like that sort of is goofy. It's really just a competition of extremely physical people doing extremely physical stuff. They're all pretty likable and they all have pleasant attitudes for the most part. So it doesn't have a lot of interpersonal drama. And eventually I started to figure out when they got down to about 20 people who everybody was, because that's about as many people as I can keep track of. So anyway, it's called Physical 100. I binged it all in one day. If you see it go by on Netflix and you're the kind of person who likes just watching people wrestle or run around doing a shuttle run or something, or you like the idea of a real life Sisyphus, check out Physical 100. On Netflix. That is what is making me happy this week. And if you want links for what we recommended, plus some more recommendations, sign up for our newsletter at npr.org/popculturenewsletter. And by the way, if you want even more Oscars talk this week, I'll be writing in this week's newsletter about how I try to make predictions about something that's almost impossible to predict. And that brings us to the end of our show. Aisha Harris, Glenn Weldon, Stephen Thompson, thanks so much for being here.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. This episode was produced by Mike Katzef and Brent Bachman and edited by Jessica Reedy and Bilal Qureshi. And Hello Come In provides our theme music. Thanks for listening to Pop Culture Happy Hour from NPR. I'm Linda Holmes, and we'll see you all next week when we'll be recapping the Oscars.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, the NPR Wine Club. Get the world of wine delivered to your door. When you join the NPR Wine Club, you'll receive the stories behind every bottle and favorite NPR shows and personalities arriving in liquid form, like Weekend Edition Cabernet and Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me Zinfandel. The NPR Wine Club is a delicious way to support NPR's programming. If you're 21 or older, uncork a special offer at nprwineclub.org/podcast.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Rosetta Stone, an expert in language learning for 30 years. Right now, NPR listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership to 25 different languages for 50% off. Learn more at rosettastone.com/NPR.
On NPR's Throughline,
we cannot function for 24 hours without cobalt because it's in our smartphone, our tablet, our laptop. And as a consequence, the lives of the people living in that part of the Congo descended into just a catastrophe.
Find NPR's Throughline wherever you get your podcasts.